DiscerningHearts.com presents Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Paula Houston, a National Endowment for the Arts Creative Writing Fellow who has published fiction and essays for more than 20 years. She is the author of The Holy Way and By Way of Grace. With Paula Houston, we go inside the pages of A Season of Mystery, 10 Spiritual Practices for Embracing a Happier Second Half of Life, published by Loyola Press. Paula, thank you so much for joining me.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be back.
A Season of Mystery, 10 Spiritual Practices for Embracing a Happier Second Half of Life. How important that is, especially in today's world, for this great baby boom that's moving forward, entering into that second half of life.
There are a lot of us. It's amazing. And we're like this huge tsunami all moving there at the same time. And it's very interesting to look around and see how, you know, as a generation, we're handling that. Some very well, and others, you know, still trying to cling on to their 40s or even younger. It's an interesting time.
Strange, isn't it, when we hear people say, well, 50's the new 40 or 60's the new 50. And I don't know about you, but 50 is 50.
Yeah, it is. It is, and that puts so much pressure on people, as if we didn't live in an already hyper-competitive society. We work so hard all the way through our starting in childhood, really, to keep up with this demand that we be productive and active and healthy and in shape and all that sort of stuff. And it's just sad to me that even when people really are in that slowing down phase, and you can feel it very strongly in your own life, but it's almost as though people are afraid to admit that, you know. We're supposed to still be wanting to go out and run marathons and conquer the Himalayas.
Or to try to look younger. And I know that there's been lots of conversations about that, and women struggle with that a lot. But there's this desire to try to hold on to a passage of our life that we seem to have we idealized it somehow, that we thought that it was more than maybe what it was?
Well, I think it's pretty complex, I think. There's a lot of different elements that go into it. But I think the business about looks and hanging on to what we look like in younger years, part of that at least is hanging on to sexual power, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, that part of our oomph in life and our ability to get ahead as younger people or whatever, it sounds crass, but it's based on how attractive we are. And as soon as we start to have those first wrinkles and gray hair and all that stuff, it's almost like we feel shunted aside. No longer are we taken seriously as young, attractive go-getters. And so it's really scary for people. You know, they feel like for older people, no one's going to pay attention to them anymore or take them seriously.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's also this great desire to have more time, to say that I need more time. I want to push aside the thought that the days are coming where in our faith that we're heading towards another destination.
I agree with you that one of the poignant aspects of getting older is that there's a kind of, unless we've come to terms with all of this, there's a sense of urgency that it just begins to grow. You know, you start to have friends who, I mean, like I did a few years ago, a really dear friend. He was only a year or two older than me. I was still in my middle 50s. She had a debilitating stroke, and 5 years later, she's still paralyzed on one side. You know, she's alive, but entered extreme old age very early. Mm-hmm. And so you start to see your friends, you know, grappling with various and sundry serious illnesses or even death. And so it gets to be a more serious business, this business of life, where you're younger and none of that stuff is usually going on. It's easy to ignore what's awaiting us. So I think that that's definitely part of it, but I like what you said about how there's a sense that something is undone and it's still needing to be done, and we don't yet really know what that is because our focus has been so much on kind of accomplishment in the world, you know, or just getting things taken care of, like raising families and putting food on the table and all that sort of stuff. And yet underneath there's this sort of nagging feeling that there's something we're made for that we haven't gotten to yet. And I think it comes out in our culture, since we don't, you know, in the wider culture, we don't have a grasp of what our divine purpose is. It comes out in the form of the bucket list.
Mm-hmm.
There's stuff I have to check off of this list to feel as though I have lived my fullest life. And so what I was trying to do in the book is to, like you suggested, you know, offer some possible practices for people to go ahead and engage in as we're moving through these later years that would make it more likely we would finally reach the place of being able to look deeply at our divine purpose and where we're headed and what still needs to be done on that level before we're ready to make that passage.
The spiritual practices that you offer, Paula, are uplifting. And I mean that in the truest sense of lifting up the soul, and it allows us to stop in the time that we're in and to be able to lift up our eyes towards Him and appreciate what's around us right now.
I think with that sense of time urgency that grows as we get older, I know my husband, who's 10 years older than me, so he just had his 70th birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And the 70th birthday, especially for a really active, you know, strong person who's used to doing a lot of physical work every day and very creative person, that was a big birthday,
mm-hmm.
you know. And he said for probably the last 3 or 4 years, life goes so fast, you know. And he says it in a kind of wistful way, like, I wish it could slow down a little bit, you know. I'd like to, and so what I keep telling him is, Mike, it feels like it's going fast because there's something it's calling out of you that you can feel. You can feel you're being called in some way to a deeper relationship with God, and that's the way it's going to slow down a little bit, is when you start really paying attention to that. You know, Kairos time, basically.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I always think of it, is that kind of suspended moment when we're not rushing forward anymore. We're simply being in what's happening. We're entering into this kind of divine time. Those moments, those little, the romantic poets used to call them spots of time, you know, where you know all of a sudden that you've been pulled out of the river for a minute, and like you say, you're standing there somewhere on that side of that mountain looking up instead of just madly forward.
This one really resonated with me, and that's listening. I encountered that recently, even in sitting at the side of a very dear 93-year-old friend who was in his final days, and asking him a question. I literally had to stop, and there was a pause. You had to wait for him to answer. If I had jumped in with a bunch of verbiage because there was this pause, I never would have caught the wisdom that would end up pouring forth from him.
Mm-hmm.
Some very deep things. But we're in this culture, even in our generation, we're not used to stopping and listening, are we?
No. Just a habit that we have because we're used to thinking that if we're not speaking, then obviously we're not thinking things through or whatever it is. It makes us, I don't know, it makes us part of the whole stream of things if we're constantly talking. And again, it's another way to step out of the stream for a while and just see what is from a different perspective. And there is nothing more wonderful, I think, than sitting beside a very old person who's about to die and just listening to see what comes out of them at that point, because it is astonishing sometimes what they'll say.
Mm-hmm. You can also get that from listening to children.
Yeah, it is. I'm sure you know about Sophia Cavalletti's books written.
Mm-hmm.
She was a dear friend of Maria Montessori, and they were both Catholic in Italy during the war. And Sophia Cavalletti was very much drawn toward a ministry with little teeny kids, and these were kids who were going through, you know, trauma because of battles and things happening in their country at the time. And And she wrote a beautiful book called I think it's called The Religious Sensibility of Children,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, just how it's inbuilt, and yet because we're too busy teaching them other things, we don't sometimes pick up on that. We don't hear how naturally they gravitate toward worship, you know, how mm-hmm. Quickly they pick up the concept, for example, of the Good Shepherd, you know, and embrace it. And I know I have little grandchildren who we live on 4 acres, and about 4 years ago we talked our oldest daughter and her husband, and at the time our little grandson, who was 2, into moving away from a real isolated area they were living in, New Mexico, because they were not close to either set of, at least going one direction or the other, you know, because they wanted to have other children. And so they moved here and on our property, and we built another little house. We see these kids every day, and now there's little Sophie, who's 2, and Eli's 5. And I learned quite a while ago that, you know, my background with kind of monastic contemplation and that life of silence and solitude, well, how are these little kids going to fit into that, you know? And I discovered that being alone with one of those kids, even both of them, but even one is better, just for extended period of time, like 2 hours straight, just being outside on a bench watching birds together or whatever, can be a deeply contemplative experience, because there's no filter in front of it. And like you say, the first thing that strikes me when I'm alone with one of those kids is just the absolute beauty of creation. You know,
mm-hmm.
how exquisite a little creature this is. And God has given this to me, you know. And mm-hmm. so you find yourself just filled with gratitude. And so I agree. Older people, little kids, can be a real huge entree into that space we're talking about of listening.
The second step is delighting. We are filled with so much anxiety these days. A lot of it's centered on what's happening exteriorly around us. Maybe it's an anxiety with jobs, at home, with other people, but also those interior anxieties that we can't quite name, but there's something deep, deep, deep down that is niggling at us somehow, that we're alone. And we need to take those times to delight, because all those moments are gifts from the one who created us and loves us.
I know. I think I especially wanted that one in there because of the tendency sometimes of we fall into just accidentally as life keeps changing and we're not keeping up with it. You know,
mm-hmm.
For example, just the super rapid advances in computer technology, internet stuff, has left some people in the dust, and especially older people who, you know, just never got it in the first place, couldn't see the need for it, and then began to secretly resent it because everything is so different now. So there's a temptation to become curmudgeonly, you know, and to be bitter and to see nothing good in what's going on around us as we get older, because it isn't the world we're used to, and we don't fit in anymore. And so I agree with you. I think that the antidote for this kind of the bitterness, which is actually disguised anxiety, is this learning how to delight in the moment. And I have to say, just the other day, my little grandson looked up at me with his big innocent eyes. He said, "Grandma, I have a question for you." I said, "What?" He said, "Are we off the fiscal cliff yet?" I said, "Where did you hear about that?" You know, he just picked it up in the wind because mm-hmm. everybody was talking about it. And and so that was delightful.
Yeah, that was delightful. And that's, again, we're talking with Paula Houston about A Season of Mystery, 10 Spiritual Practices for Embracing a Happier Second Half of Life. And it is made for the individual, but it's also made for those wonderful study groups that you might be participating in. And I think the reflection questions in the back that go through all of this help not only in that small group, but also you could journal as individuals using these same questions. I think that would be very helpful. Talk to us about the lightning practice.
Oh, this one, lightning means, you know, as it sounds, just the process of beginning to divest ourselves of all kinds of stuff, and of course a lot of that is physical stuff, just mm-hmm. the accumulated things of decades of living, and especially for folks that have stayed in the same place for a long time, it's amazing how things increase, possessions increase exponentially over the years. And my husband and I are both the oldest of five kids, and because we're the oldest, we've tended to, and the ones with the barn, we've tended to wind up with a lot of different relatives, older relatives, things kind of sneaking their way into the barn as his parents have died and mine have died. And so there's a moment where you look at all this mountain of physical items and say, someone else is going to have to go through this when I finally pass away, mm-hmm. you know. And that's one of the spurs to starting to get serious about weeding through and organizing and just simply giving away a lot of things, you know. Just a couple weeks ago, we've had the old piano that my parents bought in 1962, a baby grand that was a renovated, you know, older piano then, and that was a huge investment for them. And we had it kind of tucked in a sunroom where it shouldn't have been, so it was sort of slowly destroyed over the years, and the kids have banged on it, and several generations have grown up with it. But finally there was a point where we were either going to have to invest some money in it or, you know, give it away. And I put a little ad in Craigslist, and somebody was thrilled to death to get that mold, beat-up thing and carted it off. And, yes, there was a moment of sadness remembering all five of us children having piano lessons, my kids, you know, playing that piano when they were little, and now the grandkids playing on it. But it was time. And that's what I mean about the reason we hang on to a lot of things is that we don't know what else to do with them. But beyond that, there's a sentimental, deep attachment to the past that they represent. Mm-hmm. Being ready to move into the next phase means we have to sometimes start cutting those strings, too. There's also other stuff that goes along with the lightning process, having more to do with sense of obligation to keep doing certain things, like, for example, having a massive Christmas card list that we feel like we can't stop, you know, mm-hmm. obeying every single year, by just looking at various ways that we can simplify our existence.
Well, there's the Benedictine Oblate in you coming out.
Yes. I can't help it. And it's been, you know, for me, that's a really easy chapter to write mm-hmm. and to, but it's really hard for a lot of people. I mean, it'd be a huge discipline for many people to take on. It isn't for me. I almost have to slow myself down because I'm the kind of person that just wants to keep things very, you know, minimal. But that I respect the connection other people have with the physical artifacts of life, because I understand now more and more. My mother just died on the last month, so about a month ago. Mm-hmm. And she was the exact opposite of me in that regard. She saved everything. And so we've been going through, you know, boxes after boxes of things. And there's a certain way that those things spur reflection on a whole life. And there's value in that. But I think they can imprison us too if we don't watch out. Because I think the natural feeling is I want to be freer as I get older.
Right.
It's harder to carry all those burdens of the past.
It's hard if they become your identity.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to really ask yourself, what is the purpose of this particular object?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, does this display to the world who I am? Does this say something about who I am? Because if that thing does that, then we're in trouble, aren't we, Paula?
I think so, yeah. And I think that's really very often what those possessions do for us. They give us a kind of status in the world. My mom, a year ago, we moved her, you know, over many objections, but she finally agreed to do it. We moved her out of the house she'd been in for 40 years. She moved into a little two-bedroom apartment up here in our area so that we could be closer to her. And she said it was really interesting because it was a senior residence. How many people there still were bitter about being separated from their possessions, kind of against their wills, obviously, you know, that their children had intervened. And they hadn't gotten over that because they felt like that was them. Mm-hmm. You know, like you're saying, that was their identity in life. And now that had been torn away. So that's a dangerous zone. And it's why, you know, it's why the ancient wisdom said avarice was one of the eight evil thoughts or seven deadly sins. And avarice, not in the sense of, you know, a greedy miser at work, but just this need to be surrounded with stuff to feel okay about ourselves.
That's a tough area to kind of gently go into, because so many of us are saving up, or we've tried, and it hasn't been that easy for retirement, for that those elderly years, that we want to be able to save enough so that we can keep everything. But in the end, if you do live that long and you are able to get to that point, you find that then you're divested of those things. If we could put as much emphasis on preparing ourselves, mm-hmm. getting ourselves ready for the next journey, you know, getting ourselves ready for the next phase spiritually in our hearts, in that relationship with God, the stronger we'll be able to be when the time comes to make that passing.
Yes. And I think, again, it's something that we have unconsciously picked up from our larger culture, which isn't necessarily, you know, plugged into the life of faith, is that there is something after this. You know, mm-hmm. we're headed somewhere. We are pilgrims on the way in life, you know, as it says. And pilgrims travel better when they travel light, you know. Mm-hmm. They're more open to what comes next. And so I think as long as we look at life as this finite thing, that what we're trying to leave behind us is a huge legacy, because that's the only thing that lives on, you know, after we're gone. Well, of course, you're going to want to accumulate beautiful artwork and, you know, all these things that you can pass on to the next generations so that people won't forget you. Mm-hmm. And it is tricky business. It really is. But one of the women I talked to as I began thinking about this book was a total stranger, but she was the mother of a priest I met at a retreat center. He said, if you're writing a book about this, you've got to talk to my mom. And he gave me her phone number, and she lived in Ohio or someplace. And so here I call this 85-year-old woman completely, you know, without any introduction. And we had this lovely conversation, and I said to her, you know, how do you see all of this? And she said, oh, I think the biggest problem among Christians in this day and age is we no longer talk about the afterlife. Mm-hmm. We don't think in those terms much anymore. If we do think about them, we think, well, that's none of our business. You know, we'll let God take care of that when that happens or whatever. Mm-hmm. But to seriously see it as an enormous and difficult and challenging passageway into a whole other life and realm changes everything, I think, about how we look at possessions and, you know, legacies and all that kind of stuff.
Paula, in A Season of Mystery, there are several other principles I wish we could have more time to touch on, like accepting and befriending. I was hoping that maybe we could spend a little time on generating.
In which we think about what is it that we are, and it's different than a legacy. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that you made that segue, because, yes, to generate new spiritual life in an upcoming generation is just enormous, and it's a function that older people used to have, and it was a given that, you know, when you became, if you were blessed enough to live to an old age like that, that the assumption was you'd accumulated a lot of wisdom. As you said, sitting by your 93-year-old friend, you couldn't believe the kinds of wise things that would come out of him if you took time to listen to him. But in a culture that focuses so much on youth and, you know, achievement and things like that, we no longer look to older people for that kind of wisdom, and yet it's there in so many ways. And so to be conscious of ourselves as people who have something really important to offer, even if it's, you know, just decades of accumulated experience in dealing with, for example, grief. I mean, I think I remember being 20 years old and thinking the worst thing that could ever happen to me is to ever lose a single person I loved through death. I just feared death. I was a kid who was going to church and everything else. I thought I couldn't survive the death of one of my parents or my siblings or, you know, whatever. And then, of course, we get brought face to face with it over and over. And we learn this through a lot of struggle and grief. We learn we can survive it. You know, there's something beyond it, all that sort of thing. Well, even to bring that experience to bear on some younger person's struggle can be so helpful. And so I think just this notion that there's something we have learned in our long life, sometimes it's a skill. In my case, you know, I'm very cognizant. It's writing. That's what I do. I've done it for 40 years. I really feel called right now, this particular time in life at the age of 60, to direct my attention to upcoming young writers of faith. And that's why I accepted, you know, a year or two ago, I accepted a job teaching in an MFA program that's a, you know, got a Judeo-Christian base to it, because I wanted to help pass the torch. So anyway, that's why I focused on that particular chapter.
I hope people have, like I do, the Paula Houston Library in your section in your with your books at home, because whether it's By Way of Grace or Forgiveness, Simplifying the Soul, those are just wonderful titles. And A Season of Mystery is just such an important and welcome addition. You help us along the way. You're one who is able to point us to keep climbing, keep going. And for that, we just really thank you, Paula.
Well, thank you for saying that. You know, I think sometimes readers don't realize how many hours of solitude a person spends when they write, and that it can become a lonely profession, you know. And so it's really wonderful then to hear if something that you've put down on the page has actually helped someone clarify, you know, a question or whatever. Anyway, it's thank you for saying that.
You're very welcome, and thank you for joining us. Paula, God bless you.
And God bless you too, Chris, for what you do. I think it's wonderful.
With Paula Houston, we've gone inside the pages of A Season of Mystery, 10 Spiritual Practices for Embracing a Happier Second Half of Life. To learn more about this book or to obtain a copy, go to LoyolaPress.com. The website for its publisher, Loyola Press, or you can find it at any fine Catholic bookstore. To hear and or to download this discussion along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.